air, and it's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
No, that's the wrong noise. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. How are you? Maybe I ought to learn how to work this board. What do you think, Brendan? Maybe I ought to learn how to just push the button that makes it the ones that I want myself. All right, there you go. Mark Riley's back from his week hiatus. How was that, Mark?
Wonderful.
Yeah, what'd you do?
Nothing.
Come on, man.
Nothing.
Come on, man.
Absolutely nothing.
You didn't see a movie?
No.
You didn't go out to dinner?
Yeah.
Did you take your wife and kid out someplace nice?
Yeah.
All right,
that
there
I
you
did.
Go.
But so, mostly I slept.
You slept all day long?
Slept and read.
All right, what'd you read? Come on, give us one
news,
little...
News, man, news.
All right, dude.
News, the papers.
All right, man, there you go, there you go. Well, it's nice to see you back.
Well, thank you very much.
It's good to have you. Here we go into the last 10 shows. The last 10 shows of Morning Sedition, ladies and gentlemen. I rented a car. I know what car I'm going to get, I think. And despite what people are telling me, Riley, I think I'm going to get a gray Camry. I think I'm going to get a gray four-cylinder Toyota Camry.
And it's a great car. There's nothing wrong with that.
And I had found also that despite the fact that people have resented us for talking about Japanese-built cars, that many of the Japanese-built cars are constructed here in many different places. About 73%, it's got a sticker right on the damn car.
Ohio, Kentucky, Georgia, all over the country.
It says right on the damn car, 72% of this car was built here for one way or another.
Oh, yeah.
So I can rest assured that some American workers are being paid to make my car if I buy a gray Camry, right?
Absolutely.
All right, well, that makes me feel better. Now, I rented the car specifically to facilitate the transfer of my cats to a cargo terminal at United Airlines and take my wife to the airport with one of the cats. All right, this is what's happening in my life. And I'm going to, since you were here with me at the beginning, people, and Riley and everybody else with the cats, here's the closure of it. I've begun to look at this. I'm reframing the cat tail as their movement towards paradise. That I am freeing the cats to L.A. That they are heading towards what is ultimately a cat utopia of my backyard. How do you like that? That from the garbage can to my backyard in Los Angeles, how many people get to have lives like that? This is like a great success story. It's the underdog story for these cats, okay?
So, undercat story.
The undercat story, right. So, Monkey has made it. Monkey has made it out there. My wife took him on the airplane, and he pulled it off. I still got the two girls at home. They're going into the cargo crates, but, you know, I didn't realize about this air cargo thing. You got to call day to day because they don't take them every day.
Because, why not?
Well, it might be too cold, might be too hot. They don't want them to sit out on the runway. They don't want them to freeze. You don't want to have a pot, you know, a catsicle when they get to Los Angeles. So I got to call them today. I also had another realization over the weekend that I might be, for the people that live across the way from me, I realize that I'm a naked guy.
What?
Yeah. I do. I a lot of times I'll just go into my kitchen and cook with no clothes on, and now there's this whole new set of neighbors across the way that I'm realizing I'm standing there, and some days are better than others. Some days I'm just sort of like defiant. I'm like, yeah, take it in. What do you got? You know, what is that illegal? And then other days I feel guilty and I go put my robe on. I guess it's how confident I feel at the given moment. But I've grown to realize that I am that person for those people across the way.
Not illegal, by the way.
It's not, right?
No.
It's is it illegal if I dance around?
No, dude. It's your house. You can do whatever you want.
It's protected
by privacy laws. It's actually, you can do that in a hotel room too. Did you know that?
Did I know it? I invented it.
once you have put your money down and that you are in that hotel room, it becomes private domain of yourself, and if you're naked in front of a window, nobody can charge you with anything.
Oh, I've done worse in hotel rooms, I'll tell you. In hotel rooms, it's like the free zone. It's like, why can't I do this on the floor? Who's going to stop me? It's not my house.
I love that Brendan's done the research on it, though.
Hey, let's get back to the big struggle of last week, Riley. I don't know if you've been following the show, but we had some issues last week. They've replaced the toilet paper dispensers in the bathroom here with a single...
What?
Yeah, single sheet dispensers, which apparently... We didn't realize it, but Brendan McDonald had a completely, ruined his week. Like, he cannot function properly having to deal with single sheet toilet paper. It ruins his day.
I haven't seen that since high school.
Well, exactly.
In high school, in grade schools, that's where they have single sheet dispensers.
Yeah, because you have a bunch of immature children that'll wad up toilet paper and not
and clog the toilet up.
Exactly, behave properly. I can understand that. But how about a group of working adults trying to go about their daily business every day?
And it ruins his day. And we made a case last week that it could ruin employee confidence. It could ruin morale at the company.
Listen.
And then we started talking about it in here, and all the women came in.
Oh, my gosh.
And they were like, we thought it was just us because they need more toilet paper.
Wow.
I'm gonna read something.
I'm gonna leave that there. Yeah, go ahead. What do you got?
Don't tell me there's an explanation for this.
No, I want to say
we can't get to the bottom.
I remember this thing I saw on 60 Minutes a couple of years ago. It was about this group called SAS.
Yeah.
And they have what is considered the best workplace in America because of how they take care of their employees. I have their website up right here. It's a tech company, mm-hmm. and their motto is, if you treat employees as if they make a difference, they will make a difference to the company.
Yeah.
And they have on-site healthcare center.
Yeah.
They have wellness programs. They have a piano player in their cafeteria.
Right.
They have two child care centers on-site. They have an auto parts center. For if you come to work and your car is dead, they want you to fix your car.
That's,
wow.
And
that's, you know, amazing. What else they have?
What?
Real freaking toilet paper dispensers. Because they know that it will cause goodwill amongst their workers.
To have a freedom to make your own choice,
exactly.
of sheets of toilet paper. So now, Riley, we're trying to get to the bottom of this, and we assume that it was because we got a new bean counter here, you know, a new financial officer.
Well, right? Wait a minute. How much did it cost to install the new dispensers?
But that's not even the issue. The issue is, where did they come from? So we thought it would be the accounting thing. That might be an issue in the long run. But it turns out we asked, and Linda, who runs the she runs the office here. She goes, no, it was the cleaning company that made this decision. So then it gets kind of questionable. And I guess in terms of savings, that's a good question, ultimately. But we have heard from some emailers that said, over the long run, this saves a lot of money. But is that really the point if it ruins employee morale?
Exactly. That's such a conservative ideology.
Yeah.
It's like, no, I saved money on it, completely discounting the human element.
Right. Now, Chris, is it true that you interviewed the cleaning lady?
This is true.
Did she get us any closer to finding out who was responsible for this choice?
Well, let's find out.
All right.
Okay. No, come on. It'll be fun. No, it's okay. All right. Here, why don't you get over here? So now, what I want to ask you is, when did the new toilet roll holders happen?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
No, it's okay.
She's hiding something, man. She's hiding something.
I don't know.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah.
I don't know.
Uh-huh.
The company or the building. The super attendants.
No. This was the wrong person to talk to.
Maybe me complain for the office, for the in area the bathroom,
uh-huh.
for change for the paper towel.
Okay.
Maybe the office complains.
Now,
right.
Now, is it easier to clean up the bathrooms because of the new holders?
No.
No?
Mm.
Okay. Now, what
That's
if
yeah,
what
okay.
about like, have you ever seen anyone with that had, like, hemorrhoids? Like, you know, because it could really hurt them because they have to get, like, a lot of toilet.
Yeah, what is that, Chris?
Like, have you ever,
where'd
like,
that come?
Had that experience, you know, where like, you know, someone never complained about it?
The experience for the paper towel? Or
yeah.
Paper towel?
Yeah.
It's complicated because I remove, it's broken for the paper towel for remove.
Did she understand we're talking about paper,
paper
toilet
towel.
Paper?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this is the most problem. I suppose maybe the company or maybe the super the building.
Uh
huh. I super. Change it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's fast.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you.
Wow, that was really some amazing investigative journalism.
That was it.
Well,
hey, Chris, did you ask her whether she made the minimum wage?
No, I didn't.
See, that was another question. So she said it might be the company. Someone might have complained. It might be the cleaning company or it might be Air America. I think we got to get to the bottom.
You know what though? Doesn't make her job easier. She said.
It doesn't make her job easier, and also at the beginning she blamed a lot of people. I clearly she's not willing to divulge the information. This wasn't the right source on this. We're going to have to go in-house on this one. There's enough discontent people. There were several women here at the organization that were up in arms about these toilet paper dispensers, and then we got somebody we emailed and said, if there's one in the handicap stall, it's breaking the law. Breaking
what?
The law. Yeah.
Americans with Disabilities.
Yes.
That's right.
And
really?
And it turns out that they didn't put
right.
one in
I
there.
I thought we had them.
Yeah.
I thought we were ready to take these things down, but no, they thought.
Well, you know, there's a simple solution, and everybody who wants to use regular toilet paper just use a handicap stall.
Yes, but that's except when. What about when the wheelchair comes in and you're sitting in there going, "Oh no!" See,
how
I didn't
many
think
wheelchairs
this
have we had in here? Since
is
we
that
moved?
The right attitude, Mark Riley?
It's the real attitude. I mean, has there been somebody here I haven't known about?
I don't know. You just never know. It's that's why there's one handicap stall and there's three other stalls. Look, this is an issue that affects the workplace. It affects people's state of mind. It affects how they feel about their job. It affects how they feel about who their bosses are. You know, this is really the bottom level of malcontent that could lead to deaths in the workplace. That's all I'm saying. Is that overarching? Is that over-speculating, Brendan?
I'm worried sitting next to Dave right now, man.
That he's going to snap?
He doesn't look good.
Oh, I'd love to see Dave snap.
He just told me. He was like, you know what you do? There's toilet paper rolls that haven't been put in a dispenser yet. You just tear those off and put them on top.
Is that what you do, genius? Is that the big plan?
Well, he'll know because he ate some garlic knots this morning. He'll be in there before the rest of us.
You guys will know.
Yeah, okay, man. Well, this has digressed far enough. And so we'll move into the news in a second. 16 past the hour. Welcome back, Mark Riley.
Thank you.
Air America Radio's Morning Tradition.
Morning Tradition. Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Don't just stare at it. Eat it.
On Air America Radio.
Twenty-one past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Morning.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Good morning. It's Monday. Hope you're feeling okay. I'm pretending to feel good, and it's working, so I'm going to stick with it if that's all right. Hey, if anybody, I just read this article in the Village Voice about this Showtime horror special, Joe Dante film called Homecoming, about some Iraqi vets who were American soldiers who were killed in Iraq coming back from the dead to vote out the president. It's called Homecoming, and I didn't see it, but man, I'm not going to miss it this Friday. If anyone saw it and wants to talk about it, 1-866-303-2270. It sounds like a pretty decent bit of horror satire. Sometimes horror movies can be the most effective satire out there. Certainly the Day of the Dead and the Dawn of the Dead had some effect on me in terms of what American life is.
My English teacher was in Dawn of the Dead.
Really?
Yeah.
That makes him a satirical player in a horror movie.
Well, Dwayne Jones, who actually started the Black Filmmakers Foundation back in the day.
Well, I wonder what that experience was. So is Day of the Dead the one they were at the mall? Or was that Dawn of the Dead? Dawn of the Dead, which is the one where they do almost like the commercial thing with the beer popping and the redneck.
Yeah, that's it, Dawn of the Dead.
Oh, that's Dawn of the Dead. Yeah, he was in Night of the Living Dead. He was in the original.
All right, yeah, Dawn of the Dead was devastating. I love that movie. Let's get into this, because we're going to talk to Borzu Daragahi in a second. What is this, Riley, this piece of press that just came across our desk here? This is a horrible situation in Israel.
Yeah. Suicide bomber blew himself up. Four people have been killed. This is in Netanya. Four shoppers wounded 35 people. Apparently, it was the bomber blew himself up among people waiting to enter a shopping mall. Apparently, police have blocked off the area, and this is going to, of course, impede progress in Middle East peacemaking following a decision by Ariel Sharon to break away from his Likud party. So this is kind of it has political ramifications over and above the tragedy of people being killed, obviously.
Yeah, but most of those dude there, I think, it's horrible. And also, here's another bit of business. According to the Iraq National Security Advisor, a group called the 1920 Revolution Brigades, a Sunni Arab insurgent group, had a plan in place to fire rockets at the courthouse today during the court session of Saddam's trial. The trial, of course, reconvened earlier today after lawyers that were assassinated were replaced. The former U.S. Attorney General, Ramsey Clark, who joined Saddam's legal defense as an advisor, tried to give an opening statement that argued the legitimacy of the court, and the court wouldn't allow it on the grounds that the tribunal had been established under the law by an elected Iraq government. The judge said only Saddam's chief lawyer could address the court, and Arabic is the only accepted language of the court. And then Saddam and his legal team walked out of the courtroom in protest, citing the illegitimacy of the court. And then the court, the judge threatened to appoint lawyers if he didn't play by the rules. So we've got to talk to Borzu about that.
Yeah, that's an incredible story. A rocket attack on a courthouse?
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming it didn't happen.
It didn't happen.
We would have heard about it.
Yeah.
Now, here's a big piece that Borzu had something to do with in the LA Times over the weekend. That is pretty devastating in its own content. There are over 60 private military contracting companies in Iraq. They total about 20,000 employees. Between them, they've been awarded about $766 million in contracts. They provide security guards for U.S. officials. Those would be the contractors equals mercenary divisions. And contractors, of course, working on rebuilding. The problem is they are completely unregulated and operate seemingly without oversight or any sort of regulation, and they can and do kill people. In an LA Times survey of 200 serious incident reports filed by private security firms in November 2004, 11% of the incidents were contractors, civilian contractors, firing at civilian vehicles thought to be a threat. Now, the real problem here, the real issue, is that in many instances, people were killed, Riley. Iraqi civilians were killed, whether it was an insurgent attack or defending an official. These civilians were killed, and they have no recourse because, and maybe you can explain this to me because I don't understand. The law being honored by contractors was put in place by the Coalition Provisional Authority, which hasn't been there since, what, June 2004.
Right.
And that states that contractors suspected of wrongdoing are to be prosecuted here or whatever home country they come from.
Yes, but that doesn't always happen. And in fact, in many instances that have been documented by the L.A. Times, these people have simply not been prosecuted at all. They've been sent home, and they go back to doing whatever it was they were doing before.
Right. So that means that people in Iraq who lost family members by these mercenaries or by these actions taken by... It's bad enough that you got U.S. soldiers, in some respect, killing civilians.
Yeah.
It happens, but it's bad. And the whole war is bad, so I don't know why I qualify sometimes. But the bottom line is that now you got a security guard, a rent-a-cop shooting your kid, and you got nothing you can do about that. There's no justice. There's no action that can be taken within Iraq to find some to make somebody pay for this.
This is one of those 1,000 paper cuts that feeds the resentment of the Iraqi populace, not the Iraqi military, not the insurgency, the plain, everyday Iraqi people. This is what feeds their resentment because they don't see America as a just occupying force. I mean, it's bad enough they may see people as an occupying force, but they don't see justice. When somebody loses their kid and suddenly they can't even get any kind of compensation from anybody or any word about whether or not the person is going to be criminally prosecuted, what kind of justice do they think Americans are bringing to their country?
Absolutely. And there's another little bit we can talk to Borzu about. When Iraqi presidential candidate Ayad Alawi and some of his henchmen, who were probably some of these contractors, tried to enter the Imam Ali Mosque, which is one of the holiest shrines in the Shiite culture, a small riot broke out of people trying to block his entrance. They were throwing shoes and rocks at him. He claimed that they tried to assassinate him with shoes and rocks. He had shot some shots in the air. His henchmen fired some shots in the air coming into the mosque, which is just, in Iraq, it's a way of campaigning. It gets people's attention. Well, look, we're going to talk to Borzu about all of this stuff in just a second. Borzu is, of course, L.A. Times Baghdad correspondent. He's a frequent guest on the show, so stay with us. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Now, another great moment in Morning Sedition history.
I have turned the national anthem into a Christmas carol.
Oh, no.
A hymn to the Sturch, if you like.
No, I wouldn't go there if I were
well,
you. Please.
I'm going there right now.
No, please.
Oh, say, can you see by the Lord's early light?
No.
What so proudly we hailed at the birth of Jesus Christ.
Oh, come on. God help us.
Oh,
please. Come on. Come on. Stop it, man.
Spangled.
No.
Savior and praise.
Wait. Jesus wore spangles?
On the what? Land of the God.
Oh, no.
And the whole king of
come on.
The Jews.
This has been another great moment in Morning Sedition history.
35 past the hour, our next guest, you are listening to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron. I'm here, and that's Mark Riley.
Morning.
And he's back from his week-long vacation. That you just heard, of course, Lawton Smalls, a classic. Our next guest broke the story that the U.S. military is using PR firms like the Lincoln Group to plant positive articles written by U.S. quote, information operations, unquote, troops in the Iraqi press. He's a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times in Baghdad and a frequent guest on our show. Borzu Dargahi joins us on the phone from Baghdad this morning. Good morning, Borzu. What happened today in the Saddam trial? It sounds like it got a little crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, it's always promised to be a pretty entertaining spectacle, and today did not disappoint. You had Ramsey Clark up there speaking his two bits. You've had the Saddam Hussein standing up, chanting "Long live Iraq, long live Iraq." And then I guess most importantly, you have a witness testifying now as we speak on delayed video, testifying about what happened in the Dujail in 1982 after a failed assassination attempt against Saddam Hussein.
Borzu, is it going on now? The trial, it reconvened?
I'm watching a delayed broadcast of it on CNN. They have the delay. It's like a 30-minute delay. And, yeah, as we speak, I'm watching it on CNN.
So, Borzu, is there any chance that this is going to make Saddam Hussein a sympathetic character in that country?
I think there's that worry. I mean, a lot of people watch this, and they're like, he's very poised and, very forceful, yet calm, and he's a presence in Iraqi society still, and I guess this bolsters that. I think a lot of Iraqis are confused by this whole thing. They don't really have a culture of trials and legality as we do, and they're like, what's the point of a trial? Everyone knows who this guy is. Everyone knows what he did. Why not just execute him?
Now, Borzu, how ironic is it that you have on the one hand Saddam Hussein talking about American occupiers, but at the same time, he now has an American lawyer.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in a way, it's ironic, but it's an American lawyer who's, as New Yorkers know or probably know, is who made a career of opposing U.S. foreign policy and taking up unpopular causes, he's part of the defense team now.
We're talking about Ramsey Clark, of course. Now, Borzu, let's move a little bit into something that we just read about that you had a part of in terms of military contractors who are killing Iraqi civilians who are not being taken to task legally because of it. Now, what I want to know is why do they still follow the rules of the Coalition Provisional Authority in dealing with these civilian contractors there?
I mean, it's a real legal gray area, because on the one hand you have the, sovereign government of Iraq, and on the other hand you have the UN-mandated multinational forces, and these contractors are authorized under those under the MNFI, under the multinational force Iraq. So that's where you get the gray area. That's where you get the wiggle room, legally speaking.
So are they seeing any reprisals? Have there been any cases that you know of in Iraq or even here in the States where contractors are guilty of wrongdoing or wrongful death where they've actually been prosecuted?
Absolutely not. At this point, we've not heard of any cases of a contractor who fired upon an Iraqi civilian, for example, being brought to justice.
Borzu, how about the families of some of these people who have been shot? Have they been able to get any form of compensation at all, either from the Iraqi government or from the American high command?
Actually, that's the really sad part, because when they're killed by or hurt by U.S. soldiers in accidental incidents, there is a structure, a pretty robust structure in place to give the grieving families some money, some compensation for their loss. But as far as the contractors go, we suspect that many of the cases don't even get reported. But among the ones that do, there's no legal recourse for them.
Well, let's get into another area of contracting. There's been reports that that the Lincoln Group, which is, I guess, some sort of military subcontractor through the Pentagon, is running a PSYOPs propaganda campaign by planting American-written stories into Iraqi newspapers, translated into Arabic, that are strongly stilted towards the American point of view of what's going on in the war. Now, is there any law against that, or is that just standard for this type of thing?
I don't think there's any law against that, any U.S. law against that. It does sound really terrible, though, and it's very interesting that, the day before this story, the L.A. Times published a very large piece about death squads that didn't spark a lot of outrage. It was like about how death squads are operating in Iraq. But this story about the payola, paying newspapers to publish pro-American articles, it really touched a nerve with the American public and people at large. It just seems wrong. And I think that's, you know, absolutely. Even though it's not legally, it may not be a violation. Just something about it, ethically, you know, it's against the American spirit.
Well, it's interesting what you just mentioned. Here you have military contractors, which many of which are just basically mercenaries. Then you have military-backed death squads within the Iraqi police force. And now you have this propagandizing within the press, which is supposed to be a free press, a basic tenet of democracy, which what you just put all those together, and it does certainly make us look bad. I guess the big question is, Riley asked me this yesterday, do Iraqi people buy it?
Buy what? Buy what's in the newspapers?
Yeah.
You know, it's such a shame because this has been all over. I mean, here's the sad part is that, you know, you have these newspapers. They were really trying, a lot of them. They have some good journalists. They're making some inroads into building up a legitimate Iraqi press. And then, you know, this thing kind of comes up. And it really hurts their reputation. It hurts public trust in them. And it was all over the Arab language satellite channels, you know. And the other sort of really bad things, if they ever do a legitimate article that's, you know, kind of favorable to the U.S., you know, U.S. soldiers help out on some project, everyone will just assume that it's another piece of another psyop. Instead of a legitimate article. So it just really, this whole thing really ruins the credibility of the Iraqi press.
Borzu, there was a report that the United States actually is A, running a newspaper in Iraq, and B, operating a radio station in Iraq. Is that still going on? And what kind of credibility do those two media outlets have in Iraq?
We're still trying to figure out which of the radio stations of the new private radio stations that are out there are the secret American projects. You know, it's a real shame. I don't understand why they. You know, I mean, what would have been probably better is and a lot of people have said this. Why didn't the U.S. military just come out and give a big press conference? You know, and say, look, you know, in order for us to support the Iraqi media. And in order for us to get our message out, we are going to start placing huge ads in Iraqi newspapers, you know, to sort of, you know, bolster both the Iraqi media, give them some funding, and get our message out. And they would have been, you know, warmly accepted if they had done it that way. I don't understand why it was the secrecy, why you have to secretly buy the TV station, why you have to secretly buy the radio station, why not just do it openly?
Our guest is Borzu Dargah. He is a writer, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. He's in Baghdad. I guess the reason they do it secretly is that's the only way this administration knows how to do anything.
But, you know, I mean, it seems gratuitous.
Yeah. So, listen, does Ahmed Shalabi have anything to do with this? I know he owns a paper or he's associated with a paper.
I'm really not sure. I mean, Ahmed Shalabi's paper is pretty much pro-American in any case. They were the one newspaper that we could find that was actually publishing this stuff, just, you know, sometimes not even taking money and publishing the stuff without attributing it to anyone.
So before we go, is there any indication that this is going to be stopped now? I think is public outcry big enough on the ground there to where maybe they'll stifle this?
You know, they might, but they won't say anything about it. They won't say that we're going to stop this program. It just seems to be the way that they operate here. I just don't understand. It seems unnecessary, you know.
Yep.
If they were more open about it, it might help them, and it would, you know, sort of give a better image of the U.S.
All right, Borzu Dargahi, thanks for talking to us. Always good to talk to you.
Thanks, Borzu.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, guys.
All right, take it easy. Well, that was I was talking about that last week, Mark, is that it seems that propaganda operations, psyops operations, when an army is going in and conquering or being an imperial presence in a country, that's a way that, you know, through pamphlets or through whatever necessary, it's always been part of war.
Oh, it always has been and probably always will be. But Borzu pointed out a couple of things that are very important. A, why not just be upfront about what it is you're doing?
Well, yeah, and also just the fact that we were talking a little bit about this when the story broke last week is that why does it, if we are there nurturing a democracy, that is what they are framing this as, which clearly, you know, those of us who talk about it every day know that that's not really what's happening, but that's what they are framing this as. Why would they undermine one of the basic tenets of democracy, which is a free press?
A free press. Well, because they can. And
yes.
That's part of the problem right there, because it's not they, It's us.
It's all a big lie. That's why. We're going to talk about, guess what? Al Sharpton's going to be doing a TV show. You want to hear about that? 45 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your vlog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio. Now, another great moment in Morning Sedition history.
Let's hear a little bit of Harry Reid and try and stay awake.
Let me share with you why I believe the president's plan is so dangerous. There's a lot we can do to improve America's retirement security.
Is he about to cry?
To replace the guaranteed benefit that Americans have earned with a guaranteed benefit
cut up, Riley, of up to
40%. Make no mistake, that's exactly...
Hey.
What President Bush is proposing.
It's just a little, it was a little lame, wasn't it?
Who was that?
I think Kayla the Costco ho, Chris Lopresto, our board op.
The great one himself.
Could punch that out a little better than Harry Reid. Why don't you give it a whirl there, Chris?
Give it up, Shaolin.
Yeah, let's hear it, man.
Sure, guys. Let me share with you why I believe the president's plan is so dangerous.
Yeah.
There's a lot we can do to improve America's retirement security.
Yeah.
But it's wrong to replace the guaranteed benefit that Americans have earned with a guaranteed benefit cut of up to 40%.
Yeah.
Make no mistake, that's exactly what President Bush is proposing. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
This has been another great moment in Morning Sedition history.
51 past the hour, Kayla for president. That's what I say.
Yeah.
Hey, look at this, Riley. A couple of things. I'm getting a bunch of people pissed off me because I don't know better. And you know, I should have known when you were just saying it. The Japanese. I got an email, two emails. The Japanese made in USA cars that you insist on promoting on your show are all assembled in Republican red states with right to work laws. The unions that work so hard for the Democratic Party resent your treachery. All right.
Ohio's not a right-to-work state.
Those of us in the UAW that build American cars work for the Democratic Party on a daily basis. Those foreign cars you keep trying to sell are assembled in red states, read Republican states. Well, you don't got to be an ass about it. You know, I know how to read. You don't have to put in all caps. I understand. I'm listening to your argument. It doesn't help if you smack me in the face with it, with your righteousness. Look, I'll reassess the situation. I'm trying to meet people halfway. I was kind of excited that they were at least half made in this country by Americans because I do like the cars. I've had a relationship with Toyota cars for years and Honda cars for years. But now maybe I'll learn a lesson, but you don't need the condescending attitude. You don't need to talk to me like a snot. You know what I mean? I'll take in what you're saying, and I'll do a little research now. I'll go back to the drawing board because of the way that you provided me with information, but certainly not because of your tone of voice. Now, what do you want to say there, Riley? You want to make a correction or make let's bring up this Saddam. He's back in court.
Yeah, they're back in court, actually, after about 90 minutes. The court reversed itself and said that they would allow foreign lawyers, in this case specifically former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, to address the court. So they are, in fact, now back in court. That's what Borza was watching on CNN, CNNI.
Okay, well, there you go. So let's do this. Sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily, we have an iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's crank it up and feed it some headlines. All right, from Reuters, White House calls Democrats irresponsible in Iraq. White House calls Democrats irresponsible in Iraq. Translation, you're either with us or you're right. From ABC News, scientists weigh ethics of face transplant. Scientists weigh ethics of face transplant. Oh, boy. Scientist community trying to save face for face scientists. Come on. As a face, switch around double Rooney. All right. From Associated Press, man fined for reading porn to six-year-olds. Man fined for reading porn to six-year-olds. Translation, authorities stop Michael Jackson literacy programs. I'll huff and I'll puff and I'll blow. All right. So let's talk about our buddy Al Sharpton. What's he got going? He's going to do
the Rev.
Now he said apparently he told the Daily News he's working with CBS on a pilot for a show called Al and the Family. Al and the Family, where Al's going to play himself, but he says that won't be a problem. He's had a lot of practice.
Yeah. Let's see.
Yeah, So you don't think it's legit? You think he's really in talks? You think he's
I think he's legitimately in talks, but unless he's going to dance like he did in that commercial that he did for Fernando Ferrer. And do a little Jackie Gleason type variety. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting.
He's my man, too, by the way.
Yeah, sure. I know that trick. Say something slightly critical and then say we're buddies.
No, I'm not being critical. I've more power to him. If he gets it on TV, I'll watch it.
But
I'll TiVo it.
Well, you know what's weird is that you think that it's not that difficult to play yourself.
You think that,
but it's not. It's no easy task. I don't know. I don't know if there's a deal in place. It doesn't seem like there is definitely a deal in place according to this article. But it does. It seemed to lead me to believe that there might be. You know, they make a lot of shows that we never see, Riley. Some people are starting to write in about that. About that Showtime horror hour that Joe Dante created. It's called Homecoming. There's a horror series on Showtime that is presenting a bunch of different horror shows, but apparently this might be really really a powerful satire. It's apparently there's characters in it that resemble Cindy Sheehan, there's characters in it that resemble Ann Coulter, and according to Joe Dante, what happens in this movie, according to the Village Voice, which made me want to see it, is that some American soldiers who were killed in Iraq come back from the dead in mass and go into voting booths to vote the president that sent them to war out. Now, apparently there's a Cindy Sheehan-like character, but Joe Dante says that Cindy Sheehan hadn't even surfaced as an activist while they were shooting this film. There's an Ann Coulter-like character who actually provokes the corpses to take action when the Ann Coulter character says to the mother character of one of the dead soldiers, well, why don't we see if your son came back from the dead, you know, what he would say about this country. And that apparently is what provoked the zombies to come out of the is that right, John Crimmins? Am I capturing that?
Exactly right, yeah.
And did you find it to be impactful? Did you find it to be thought provoking and revolutionary in its content?
Yeah, I thought it was really well done. I'm not really one for the horror zombie genre, but
right. The
political points it made are some points that you don't really see in entertainment these days.
Sure, that's boy genius John Crimmins here at the our morning sedition researcher and hands-on the phone guy. Now, look, the bottom line is that's true. You don't see this kind of stuff. And the reason why it's not being criticized, I was talking to Brendan McDonald yesterday, and it was a very astute insight, was that they can't afford to draw attention to any sort of activism against the war at this point because the public is sympathetic with it.
We got polls, too, don't we?
Right, so Bill O'Reilly's not saying nothing about it. Hannity's not saying nothing about it because they know the public isn't on our side.
Yeah.
See? These guys are wussies. They're not courageous at all. They'll just go however it flows. It's 57 past. When we come back, we're going to be talking to John Belushi's widow about a book that she wrote about John, and she definitely takes Bob Woodward to task. Here. It's 6 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yo.
He's back. He's back from a week resting up, getting fed properly, getting his shut eye, getting strong. Did you go to the gym? You didn't once, did you?
I went to the gym 3 times.
Come on, really?
I'm going to the gym 3 times a week from now on.
Why would that? Your wife said you were fat.
No.
Come on,
I just resolved that this is what I was going to do.
Come on, did your wife say you're fat?
No.
Come on, be honest.
No.
Did your wife say, get off the couch and go to the gym?
No, I just decided it was time to start going to the gym 3 times a week like I thought I was going to and had slacked off from.
Is it because of cardiovascular reasons? Because you think you're fat?
No, it's because I feel better when I go to the gym.
Come on, dude, there's got to be some self-image involved here.
No, I have no self-image. I lost that in the early 80s.
Really? Is that why you still get your hair cut?
I get my hair cut just in case they ask me to do TV.
Oh, okay. So
The way, we'll talk about this off the air, but there's a very interesting sidebar to that story about Borzu. That Borzu reported about the, because I almost got asked to do a TV show about it, and then they decided not to do the segment. I'm not going to say what network it was, but they decided not to do the segment because they didn't want to appear to be critical of the administration.
All right, so Borzu Daragahi, our Baghdad guy who writes for the LA Times, in talking about the military contracting of journalists, is that what you're talking
yes.
about? So you were going to do a TV show that was based on that to comment on that.
Okay, the TV segment, yeah.
A TV segment, and then they pulled it because they didn't want to offend the administration.
I had a long talk with their producer for like a half hour.
All right, so I'm going to do some probing investigative journalism. What network?
I'm not telling.
Why wouldn't you tell?
Because I'm a journalist.
Wow.
That's right. And it's
so,
Monday.
So you're protecting your source?
I'm protecting myself. Look, they're not bad people. I just know that there was a sensitivity about this for a very specific set of reasons.
God, we had an opportunity to break news here, Riley. All right. Look, in what American counterterrorism officials called a major blow to al-Qaeda, a guy named Hamza Rabia was blown to pieces with four others in a village in northern tribal stronghold of Pakistan, an area that is known to shelter militants. Now, they're saying this guy is the number three al-Qaeda guy. This would be the fourth number three al-Qaeda guy that has been killed or captured. It isn't clear who blew them up. It could have been a missile delivered by a drone aircraft executed by the CIA. Or not. Mm-hmm. U.S. Security Advisor Stephen Hadley, who was all over the news this last weekend, was unable to confirm Hamza's death, let alone how it happened when he appeared on Fox yesterday. Now, how is that he was unwilling, as a representative of the United States government, as a representative of the White House, was unable to really fully confirm it when it has been confirmed by other outlets? How does that happen?
Well, that could mean to some that America had some hand in this attack.
Oh, so he's protecting that.
He's just saying, look, we'll let others confirm that he's dead, and then send a little missive to somebody saying, nice job.
Right. This guy Hamza was an Egyptian. He was in his 30s. He's in a top operational role in terms of organizing and executing external operations for al-Qaeda. He was also believed to be the main al-Qaeda middleman controlling foreign money for militants in Pakistan. Saudi money, no doubt. I'm so tired of seeing these stories about Americans taking action against what they're calling al-Qaeda or what they're calling terrorists without seeking any sort of actions in Saudi Arabia. What the hell is going on in that country? We talked to Bob Baer last week or the week before, and he said that a lot of the jihadists who are operating in Iraq, Saudis. I can guarantee you that this guy, an Egyptian, was tied in with the Egyptian Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood out of Egypt that is now in Saudi Arabia, and the money he was facilitating or controlling was foreign money from Saudi Arabia. I can guarantee you. How come we never hear about anybody seeking reprisals against Saudi Arabia? Enough of this lying. I mean, we go on. It makes me feel like a dupe, Riley. We go on talking about global terrorism, about Iraq being a terrorist manufacturing plant and training new terrorists against the U.S. troops, which is true. Here in Pakistan, this guy gets killed. But the bottom line is that most of the money and most of the training and most of the education that goes into fueling global terrorism comes out of Saudi Arabia, and you never hear word one about it.
No, you don't hear a lot about Saudi Arabia, and there's a one-word answer as to why.
Oil!
There you go.
And there are business partners, but it just kills me because almost it's one of those things where it's like everything we're doing, it's useless, it's futile, that, we're just skirting the issue. And even if you're progressive, even if you're coming from the other side of things and trying to be critical of this administration, you're still skirting the issues because we're honoring the information that we're getting out of these outlets. The bottom line is that most jihadist thought and most aggressive jihadist leaders come out of Saudi Arabia. Never hear about it.
Not only that, when you look at how al-Qaeda has operated since September 11th, you begin to understand, any of us who've covered the drug wars in this country during the 1970s and early 1980s, and particularly the crack trade during the mid-1980s, understand that al-Qaeda works the same way drug dealers work.
Mm-hmm.
A drug dealing hierarchy works. Okay, so you take this guy out. Great move. But the bottom line is, there's going to be five guys on that corner next week replacing him and doing what he used to do. That's the nature of these kinds of operations, and they operate the same way drug cartels do.
And that's absolutely right. And every time you read a story like this, the U.S. press says, this is really going to take a blow. This is really going to give him a blow.
Yeah,
this is
right.
going to take him down. And there is absolutely no way to stop this ideology on some level, and there is no way to stop this militarism in terms of jihadism on another level, because as you said, there are people chomping at the bits. I mean, here you got these four guys that escaped from that prison in Afghanistan that defied all odds, and they found their way out, and these guys were aggressive dudes, and every time the four guys like that gets out, or every time that somebody gets killed, I'm telling you, five new jihadists are born, at least.
At least, and you also have the idea, you may have Bin Laden and Zawahiri and the rest of these guys on the one hand, but you got Zarqawi, who's operating as an independent contractor, as far as this insurgency is concerned. So, you know, what is the impact on Zarqawi's operation on in terms of this guy getting killed? Absolutely nothing.
Yeah, and what is the answer? You know, how do we resolve this? How do we resolve it? And especially given the fact that the 9/11 Commission members are now, you know, coming out publicly. I saw a couple of them on the show. I saw Keene and another one on, I believe.
Oh, Tom Kane and Lee Hamilton.
Yeah, yeah. Are coming out and talking about how the administration is not meeting any of the proposals, the security measures that the 9/11 Commission put forth, you know, after months of trying to figure out what needed to be done. This administration is only enacting maybe one or two. And this is the problem, is that is where the focus needs to be. If there's no deterring a renegade form of Muslim ideology that is viral in its spread in this world, if they're not going to approach that on a foreign policy level, the least we can do is figure out ways to protect this country in terms of something that to a lot of people is inevitable, which is another terrorist attack of some kind.
Well, what we see here, and it runs across the length and breadth of this administration, they take shortcuts when it comes to foreign policy, they take shortcuts when it comes to terrorism, and they do cosmetology when it comes to fixing problems.
Well, let's get into that in a little detail in just a second about the 9/11 Commission. We've also got Judy Belushi is going to be out here to tear Bob Woodward a new one and to talk about her new book on John Belushi, one of my comedic heroes. So hope you're looking forward to that, and we'll check back with you in a second. It's 14 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
This is Cindy Sheehan. Whether I'm waking up in Crawford, Texas, Washington, D.C., or Vacaville, California, I wake up with Mark Maron and Mark Riley. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
What? Over? Did you say over? Nothing is over until we decide it is. Was it over when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor? Hell no!
Germans? Forget it, he's rolling.
It ain't over now. Because when the going gets tough, the tough get going. Who's with me? Let's go! Come on!
This could be the greatest night of our lives, but you're gonna let it be the worst.
Oh, we're afraid to go with you, Pluto. We might get in trouble.
Well, just kiss my ass from now on! Not me! I'm not gonna take this! Warmer, he's a dead man! Marmalade, dead! Niedermeyer!
Dead. It's 20 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Judy Belushi Paisano, the wife of the late John Belushi, will be out here in just a few minutes with Tanner Colby, who co-authored Belushi, a biography, to talk about what an ass Bob Woodward is and what a great comic genius John Belushi was. Certainly an inspiration of mine. Hey, folks, we know things are tough in the job market right now, so we've decided to help out. We scanned through the Sunday Help Wanted listings and found this for our Morning Sedition Monday job listing.
Oh, boy.
You know, sometimes these are political and astute, but hey, job seekers, prostitution is illegal in Australia, but there's a shortage in the rural areas, where some of the prostitutes are as old as 70.
Whoa.
It looks like they're looking for some fresh faces. Experienced. How would you like to go down under? No, that's not a misprint. Let us explain. We're Australia, a major industrial country. Okay, maybe not major, but everybody likes us, with the cute accents and relative harmlessness and all. But a boat gets lonely in the outback, and Frankly, we're looking for someone to add a new wrinkle. Actually, fewer wrinkles would be nice. What we're saying is experience is good, but not too much experience. You know what I'm saying? Nobody wants to order a steak and end up eating jerky, if you know what I mean. You getting this? Specifically, we're looking for people to provide services to Australia's extensive rural areas. Think of it as touring the bush with the bush. And there's no better way to experience the outback than on your back. You'll like us. Remember how big Crocodile Dundee's knife was? You get our drift. So come on down. We'll put a shrimp in the barbie. No, that's not a misprint. Making a transition to a less progressive format. Hey, I'm kidding. A shrimp in the barbie. That's something. According to several members of the 9/11 Commission, said the administration is dropping the ball in terms of following through with proposed security measures made by the panel. This is the real deal. Since the report came out in July 2004, the administration has created a National Intelligence Director position. That's John Negroponte, correct?
Yes.
What has he done lately? Is not clear. He says things are being done, but he won't say what. When that's the case with this guy, you can be pretty sure that civil liberties are being trashed somewhere. If John Negroponte is saying we're keeping it under wraps, there might be death squads in New York. Some of the proposals that have seemed to have been completely stalled are improving communications among emergency responders, shifting terrorism fighting money so it goes to the state logically most at risk. Now, apparently, Riley, am I wrong? There were bills proposed to reroute the money to states that more desperately needed terrorist protection, but they didn't get any traction because legislators don't want to give up free money for their states, even if it could make the country safer.
Well, not as long as they can get reelected by telling everybody they brought it.
Yeah, but I mean, that money, hasn't, from all indications, been misapplied in some cases?
In some cases, and there are a lot of people here in New York that are wondering where our $20 billion is.
Exactly. Thomas Keene, the former chairman of the committee, said that Transportation Security Administration was wrong in lifting the ban on sharp things. He also said that's unbelievable. The TSA should have no effective consolidated database with information and files on terror suspects. Democratic Commissioner Jamie Gorelick cited a failure to ensure foreign nations are upgrading their security measures to stop nuclear, biological, and chemical materials from getting into the wrong hands. She also cited the FBI's stubbornness in retooling their anti-terror program. So it doesn't sound like they've done much of anything, Riley. Am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. And remember that Jamie Gorelick was the person that they tried to literally run off the commission. She was the one that they, oh, she's partisan, ah, she's a Democrat, ah, she's a hack. The fact is, it's a bipartisan commission, whether it's you're talking about Lee Hamilton or Tom Kaine. Lee Hamilton's a Democrat, Tom Kaine's a Republican, and what they're saying is the administration is not doing its job.
And here's the scary thing. Daniel Benjamin, the former National Security Council staffer and author of The Next Attack, on our show last month said this.
Do you think an attack is imminent here?
I don't know if it's imminent or not here, but it's coming.
Yeah, well that's kind of interesting talk.
Well, no, we don't know the timeline because these guys are extremely careful. They plan, they work for a long time. And the other thing to remember is they're getting what they need in Iraq in terms of recruits and in terms of showing that they're the heroes of Islam. So, you know, the actual calculation, it's hard to say when it'll happen here.
Well, look, and also there was another conversation, by the way, that was Daniel Benjamin, former National Security Council staffer and author of The Next Attack. He was on our show last month. And when we were live over at the New School, we had a conversation with Bob Kerry, and we talked about the 9/11 Commission specifically. He was on it, and he said this.
Now, how about the government's poor response to this hurricane situation? I mean, we talked to Larry Johnson the other day, and how safe is the country? He doesn't seem to think it's very safe.
No, I think with all evidence in after the hurricane, we failed the first big test after 9/11,
mm-hmm.
and failed it miserably.
Well, that's some grim reality from Bob Kerry and from Daniel Benjamin. I mean, the fact that something could happen that probably will happen, that's what all these cats said too. Some of these commissioners I saw on television, they were saying, "Look, it's not if, it's when." That's horrifying to me. So the fact that this administration is not doing everything they can to buttress and provide some sort of protection from the possibility of another terrorist attack. I know in New York, they're fairly solid in their investigative. The police department, I believe, I'm assuming though, Riley.
The local police.
The local police, I'm assuming, are doing the big work in monitoring what could be terrorist cells or suspected activity. But you don't hear that stuff.
Well, that really is only in the New York area. that the New York Police Department's monitoring, and we're lucky because we got a former counterterrorism guy who's our police commissioner. The rest of the country, unfortunately, does not, at least not in most instances. And what you're finding is that politics is playing a role in who gets funded, where the money is going, and the extent to which the country is actually doing anything to try and thwart another terror attack.
Well, look, a little bird told me, you know, we just had a conversation about Saudi Arabia funding global jihadism. And Saudi Arabian money, you know, is a large percentage of the economy in this country. And according to Bob Baer and many other people in the know, they say that much of jihadism intellectually and the leadership elements come from the schools of Saudi Arabia, because that government is in an unholy alliance with the extreme Wahhabists who occupy that country and the royal family. So they give them money and they support their school system and they fund global terrorism. Well, a little bird just told me that Pakistan, as well, as we know, that country is loaded with radical Muslims, jihadist Muslims, and that government also is in a precarious position to have to accommodate them to some degree. That's why we don't know who the hell killed this guy,
Al-Qaeda
guy, because the knowledge of the truth could diminish some power of the people of Musharraf there in Pakistan. Very complicated.
Yeah.
So let's lighten it up a little bit. Judy Belushi is going to be here in just a second to tear Bob Woodward a new one and reignite our appreciation of her husband who passed. 27 past the hour, Air America Radio, this morning's edition.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. Another great moment in Morning Sedition history.
Wait, I actually see something here. I want to kind of describe it for people because I'm not quite sure what to make of it either. There's a commotion down by the stage area because
really?
This big thing is being lowered down. So I want to wait and see what actually is coming.
What is it?
It now. It's kind of like a platform with people on it. They look like big old people on there. I can't really tell what. Well, I definitely see one guy coughing. They look like sick old people on there. They're probably just a dozen or so people supposed to symbolize America's elderly, from what I can tell. There's a big length of rope next to him. A guy is a stagehand, I guess. He's grabbing it, and I can't really tell what that is. He's got his hand. It's like a torch or something, but I don't really know. Wait a minute. Oh, first in the face! He's first in the face! Get out of the way! I don't understand what's going on over there! Flames everywhere! It's burning!
Terrible!
Oh, my! Get out of the way!
What's happening?
Mark, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, my God! Republicans are burning old people! They're bursting into flames, and their social safety net is falling on the mooring lines! All the folks between! This is terrible! This is the worst of the worst policy catastrophes in the world! Oh, wow! Billions and trillions of dollars is terrible! Destruction, ladies and gentlemen. America's old people are bursting into flames, and now they're finally crashing to the ground, not quite past the mooring boat.
Oh, my God.
Oh, the humanity.
This has been another great moment in Morning Sedition history.
Oh, boy. The genius of Brendan McDonald, 35 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
We are reliving the past because these are one of the last. This is our 10th to the last show. We've got 10 more shows to do. Now let's get into our guest, because this was a very important part of my life. 20 years after the release of Bob Woodward's Wired, The Short Life and Fast Times of John Belushi, our next guest has decided that it's time to set the record straight. She's the wife of the late John Belushi, and she's co-authored with Tanner Colby Belushi a biography. Judy Belushi Paisano and Tanner Colby both join us in the studio this morning. Good morning to you both. Welcome.
Hey, Mark.
Morning.
I'm so glad you came, and I tell you, I'm so glad you wrote this book, because I was just going through it and literally tearing up my friends, tearing up because I loved this guy. He was one of the most important comedic presence in my early life, to the point where I think, I mean, everyone I know had a Belushi impression, and I'm really grateful that you guys wrote this book.
Thank you.
Now, is it coincidental? I guess it has to be coincidental that Bob Woodward has taken so much flack, and you have plenty of flack to give him, huh?
He's trying to just make it up to me by having all these bad things happen to him at once.
This is
karma coming full circle.
Now, in Wired, which I wouldn't read because I refuse to read books, I would not read Goldman's book on Lennon or Lenny Bruce. I wouldn't read Elvis as well. And I wouldn't read Wired for the same reason, because I figured it would not represent the man that I grew to love. Is that what happened? He actually went out of his way to misrepresent him, didn't he?
Well, he sort of started off with a thesis about John. He called Dave Thomas from SCTV. This is just one example of thousands. And he called Dave Thomas, and Dave Thomas was like, well, why are you writing a book about John Belushi? And Woodward said, well, he was the king of all media. He was, had a television show and albums and number one movie, and he was a media icon. It's like, oh, so that's the thesis of your book then? And Woodward said, no, the thesis of my book was that he was on a self-destructive path and his death was inevitable. And
he forgot to tell me that, unfortunately.
Right, yeah. And Thomas was like, huh? Thomas, who knew John quite well, was like, well, that seems a little odd. I must be the last of your interviews. And Woodward said, oh no, I haven't started yet.
So that from the very beginning, yeah. And you had talked to Bob Woodward before about how
approached him.
Okay.
Because there were just a lot of questionable things that had happened in L.A. when John died.
Uh-huh.
And I had all these odd calls from people and whatnot. And so I had taken my information to Woodward and said, this just seems something's wrong. And he said, I agree. I'll go do it, and we'll write an article about it. And then he said, this is really big. I think a series of articles. And then it became a book.
So, but his intentions initially, when you talked to him and had him help out to suss out some of the mysterious elements of your former husband's death, did he indicate to you that he would write a book that honored John Belushi?
Well, you know, he kept saying it's a big story. You know, this is a cautionary tale. And, of course, you know, John had just died. And I was, if something good could have come from that, I was all for it.
Right.
And, you know, so I went with one mindset, and he had a whole other mindset, apparently.
Now, I saw a quote from Blair Brown, who was John Belushi's co-star in Continental Divide, that said that this was the first time she had ever been duped by the media. Now, was that a widespread perception about what happened?
Yeah, when the book came out, everyone felt that way. I mean, you know, people talked to him because I asked them to. It was really a sordid tale. And people felt that either they'd been misquoted or something fabricated that wasn't what they said, or more often the case was simply they had a whole bunch of stuff to say, and they answered his questions about the drugs. Because I'd said, yeah, we're talking about that.
Sure.
And then they'd read it, and all it was what they told them about the drugs. And, you know,
right.
So it really hurt, because you looked at this book, and it was like a bad play, you know. Or the play was, it was just this off. The actor was wrong. The wrong person was in the role, you know.
Right.
Just everything was wrong about it. You didn't have, if you knew John, you read that book, and there was no sense of John.
Yeah, I mean, it almost killed Mike Chiklis' career to even portray him in a film because...
well, because everyone was so angry about what happened.
Exactly,
yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah,
so anyway.
Our guests are Judy Belushi Pisano and Tanner Colby, co-authors of Belushi, A Biography, which is a beautiful big coffee table book with pictures of John's entire career, from very early on. And I want to know, how did you guys get together? Tanner Colby, what is your interest in John Belushi? How did you guys pull this off?
Well, I was re-syndicating the National Lampoon Radio Hour. My business partner Alan Donez and I had started doing that, and Judy was incredibly helpful to us in clearing the rights to the original show, because John was the creative director of that, and we needed some sign off for names and likenesses and so forth. And I knew the publisher, Rugged Land, here in New York, and they asked me to get in touch with Judy about a John Belushi coffee table book,
mm-hmm.
just pictures and sort of a scrapbook kind of a thing. And so that was originally how we started out on this, and Judy asked me if I'd help him put it together. And I'm really a comedy writer, not a biographer per se. And
I'm really a mother.
Yes. And so I went up to the Vineyard, and Judy's like, oh, I have everything in my attic. It's all there. And I started going through her attic, and as you see from the pictures...
I know, it's all here.
And it's all there in terms of the pictures and the clippings and so forth, but not really all of the interviews. And I I sort of started going through it, and I said, Judy, you know, there's a real story here that's never been told. And
I was looking for the easy out. I just thought we could do the coffee table thing, and I had these transcripts, and I wanted to, they were a video.
So this is a transcript of something you shot on
video? Yeah, I had video stuff, so I thought maybe we'd have a DVD, which actually the publisher was willing to do, and maybe a CD from the Lampoon work. And when Tanner started reading the transcripts, he said, you know, this really tells a story here. This is, we could just do it from just this.
Well, there were about 20 interviews, but we needed about 80 more. And so I said to Judy, I mean, after Wired came out, so many people got burned, and a lot of people didn't work for a long time after Wired. A lot of people's careers were hurt by it, and nobody was willing to talk again.
Like, what do you mean? How were they hurt? I mean, I knew Mike Chiklis was sort of blackballed for taking the role, but who else was...
Well, you know, Don Novello was so closely tied in with the whole End Game, because he was working on a screenplay with John.
Which he had nothing to do with.
Just by
association, though, from...
A lot of people know Don Novello as Father Guido Sarcini.
Great guy, really funny. Yeah.
And he taught... Bob Weiss was the producer on Blues Brothers, and the whole opening passage of the book, Woodward just makes Bob Weiss look like a cocaine dealer, and he's not. He's a producer of the movie.
Who did a great job, and that was actually amazing. That was like the troops. The shooting Blues Brothers was a huge feat.
Right, and so that was a big smear on Bob Weiss's reputation. And so a lot of people just didn't want to talk again for 20 years, and that's why John's real story has never been told. I don't think anyone was going to open up about John until Judy gave the okay to do it again, and Judy had moved on with her life. She had a family, and so there was a lot of friction that needed to be... Somebody needed to break friction on it.
So it's all in here now.
Yeah, and
well, you know, the thing I'm curious about. I mean, some people are going to say, "Well, it's almost like that thing from The Godfather: revenge is a dish that's best eaten cold.
Revenge is neat. Revenge is sweet. It's surely got forgiveness meat."
There you go. But I mean, you held this in a lot of this stuff in for 20 years.
Well, no, not. I mean, in terms of anger.
Well, I mean, specifically really anger at Bob Woodward and the ability to respond to him.
Actually, I wrote a book called Samurai Widow, and I was documenting that process and actually document a lot, meeting him and getting involved and the book coming out and all that. So I was able to deal with that for myself. This book is really more. So that was for me, and this book is more for John and his friends and his family and the people who helped make the mistake. I think we got it now, and we're getting great response from those people who are saying, thank you. You made me remember what I loved about John. I laughed again. I feel like I just spent time with him.
It's a book for the fans, too. I mean, because I didn't know John Belushi other than I was... I laughed at him a lot, and I was a great appreciator of what he did. And this book is certainly a great book for the fans because it really gets into so much of it. Gets into actually honoring, you know, John Belushi. Who were some of the people that you talked to that really had an impact on you?
Christopher Guest, Harold Ramis was really, really smart, and Joyce Sloan at Second City. One of the things that really has been lost about John. Is when John showed up at Second City, it was really kind of stale, and it sort of...
What year are we talking here?
1970.
Okay.
The 60s had sort of passed Second City by. It was still sort of trapped in the 50s.
And he was very intellectual.
Yeah, very cerebral, and
is that what Del Close was there? Was he there?
Del Close was
doing the improv, his improv tradition.
He had the style and the influence on the acting style, but the theme was really always like, let's have pathos.
And theatrical.
Right. When John showed up, it was very intellectual premise based, and John sort of brought a new kind of character based improv where he was just... He acted as real people. And when Bill Murray described it as when you saw John doing improv, it was like you saw a whole new idea up on stage that had never been done before. And John really created that at Second City, brought it to New York at the National Lampoon, brought Harold Ramis and Bill Murray and all of these people to New York and Gilda. And really brought all together the farm team for what became, you know, Saturday Night Live. And both from a creative perspective of creating this kind of humor and being one of the first people to do it, to his clout in the industry after Animal House, John brought all of these people along with him. And Bill Murray said in an interview about a month ago that he more or less owes his career to John. And you wouldn't have this comedy industry the way we see it today without John. He's really kind of an important figure in that revolution. I mean, there were many people that were a part of that revolution, but John was really in the vanguard
of modern radio, film, and television comedy.
Yeah, most people don't know he did radio, and that's a really important part of his career in that...
A lot of people don't know I do radio.
You see, you do have a lot in common. just, you know, working in the studio and having the freedom to have these actors. I mean, Gilda Radner and the people we mentioned. Chevy Chase was there then, Chris Guest.
The National Lampoon
Radio. Richard Belzer, all these people would come, you know, and I worked on that at the time, too, and perform, and it was just great. And then sit around and we'd edit it, and it was really a wonderful growth time.
Uh-huh.
For work and really pulling things, getting a tight show. He was in charge of that. And Michael Donahue had been the first creative director, and actually he it was his idea, the whole radio show. And it was really great from the beginning, but it was very different when Michael did it. It was sort of bits and pieces and kind of all
dark
over.
And be, weird.
And sometimes dark and weird.
Dark
and then he'd like to do that sweet thing he would do.
Now,
Mr. Mike.
Yeah. Did you talk to Lorne Michaels?
Yes, I did.
And how was that for you?
It was fine.
Did he melt you with his gaze?
No. We talked on the phone, so I didn't get any laser-like gaze. But no, Lorne Michaels was very insightful and has a lot of perspective, having had a couple hundred people come through his office.
Yeah. And I had a meeting with him once, which obviously didn't pan out that well because I'm not on SNL and you don't know me.
John's first meeting didn't go well either, though.
It didn't? Yeah.
No, it didn't. You'll read about it later.
Oh, so maybe I'll get a second one when I'm 50.
Yeah, right.
No, John almost didn't get the audition, and then he was fired a week before the show went on the air, and Ann Beats made him go back and apologize to Lorne. Otherwise, he never would have been on Saturday Night Live.
Oh, well, there's a story that you can read in the new book, Judith Belushi Pisano and Tanner Colby. Thanks for being with us.
We also have the original length of the book was about twice as long, because there's so many great stories about John. We've collected a lot of those stories on our website, BelushiBook.com.
There you go.
And one more thing.
Yes?
Yes.
We're going to do a book signing at the Lincoln Center, Barnes & Noble, tonight.
Great.
And Dan Aykroyd will be with us.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and we really need those Belushi fans to come down.
Okay, well, that's great.
Now, and everyone.
I got to say one thing, Tanner. As a comedy writer, you really need to let yourself go a little bit. This guy is like...
I'm working on him.
Look how together he's got a good haircut. He's wearing a suit jacket. Mm-hmm. You got to honor the legacy of Belushi. Take him out and get him drunk or something, will you? Well, thanks for you guys. Thanks for the
book.
Thanks
a lot.
It really
it's
going to mean something to me. I appreciate you being here. 48 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning's Edition continues shortly.
You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
No, we're not homosexual, but we are willing to learn.
Air America Radio.
Now, another great moment in Morning Sedition history.
So now I'm going to give you my dream from last night.
Uh-oh.
Here we go. I'm the newest member of U2. I play the kazoo. So clearly, they're going in a new direction musically. So I'm sitting around with Bono and The Edge and Larry and the skinny bass player with the granny glasses, and we're talking about songs for the new album. Bono says, I've got some songs about AIDS in Africa and third world debt and reduction and Jesus. Ed says, I've sketched out four tunes about renewing our hope and discovering the decency inside each of us. Larry says, I've laid down some demo tracks about how perseverance and courage can overcome despair. And the skinny bass player says, I'm kicking around some material about the Montgomery bus boycott and the miracle of childbirth. They all nod, and then Bono says, so Mark, what have you got? I clear my throat and adjust my wraparound Bono sunglasses and say, I've written a song called Smack the Ass with two Z's. They stroke their unshaven chins for a second and nod. Bono says, so, is it a metaphor for American imperialism or the war in Iraq? I say, no, Bono, it's about smacking a girl on the ass because she's got a hot ass. And the Edge says, but Mark, after you smack her ass, do you feel the emptiness of the material world and embrace the spiritual essence? I say, no, Edge, after I smack her ass, we get all nasty and freaky. And then Larry says, so the song's really slow and mournful, right? It's an ironic commentary on the difficulty people have connecting on anything more than a superficial level. I say, no, Larry, I thought we'd all do it full blast with lots of sirens and moaning effects and a solo for me on the kazoo, maybe. And then the skinny bass player says, so it's a mindless party song for teenagers to get drunk and have unprotected sex to. I say, yeah, basically that's it. They look at each other for a minute and Bono says, boys, I think we've got our first single. I woke up and my bed was filled with an unforgettable fire.
This has been another great moment in Morning Sedition history.
All right, 55 past the hour. We just got another call from management at Air America Radio saying this show has to make more money or else I might not get my big raise. Oh, boy, yeah, big raise. All right, fine. So now the big raise is I go away. So now we present today's Morning Sedition Product Placement Minute. What's our product placement news story today, Riley?
22 dead bodies are on display for tourists in New York City's South Street Seaport. All of them preserved and with their skin cut away to show actual human bones, musculature, organs, and fats. It's a show called Bodies, the Exhibition.
Wow, that sounds creepy. Where'd they find these people?
They were specimens from a Chinese university, Mark. Supposedly they were indigent, unclaimed, or unidentified. But China does have a record of using organs from executed prisoners. So who knows?
Wow, that sounds unethical. And, hey, is that a pie?
Sure is, Mark. Country apple from Baker Square.
Baker Squares? I love Baker Squares pies.
Good, because workmen are going to fill our whole studio with them.
Yay! Here they come!
The exhibition includes a display of smokers' lungs that could strike home with a lot of people. One lung tissue sample is dark brown and blackish with emphysema. Another is covered with small brown tumors from metastatic cancer.
Oh. Holiday pies first, Riley. Pecan, pumpkin, and pumpkin cream. Just in case you didn't get your fill at Thanksgiving.
One body has its brain and spine exposed, and sits like Rodin's thinker, staring at another brain in a display case. One corpse is cut in half lengthwise and plays patty cake with itself. And one man is posed running with his muscles partly detached and fluttering off his body like meat feathers.
Triple berry pie. Blueberries, raspberries, and boysenberries served with ice cream and triple berry sauce. And the lemon supreme, a layer of cream cheese covered with tangy lemon filling.
So if you want to see a brain with an abscess or female breasts laid out in a display case like something from Silence of the Lambs, Bodies, the Exhibition, will be in New York for at least the next 6 months.
Hey, and why not stop in at Baker Square for some carrot cake? That's today's Morning Sedition Product Placement Minute. I'm going to go see that exhibition, actually. I saw pictures of it when it was somewhere else, and it looks pretty creepy and weird.
Uh-oh.
But captivating, completely captivating. When we come back, we've got things.
We got somebody we've captivating. We got John Nichols.
John Nichols in Morning Remembrance. So stay with us. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition.
All right, thing. What kind'd you get?
I guess for our American listeners, Zenith.
You got a Zenith?
I got a Sony.
Well, you know, these union auto worker guys, they got me thinking. I understand their argument, and I got a couple of emails from some union guys when I talk about buying a Toyota, and they're basically saying, look, you know, the Toyotas, even though they may be assembled or some of the productivity may come in America, it's primarily in red states. It's also it works against the unions. Those places, they work with the right to work laws, and they've made me rethink it. They've made me rethink it.
You buying a Buick?
No, I'm not buying a Buick, but I'm going to keep shopping because I would like to buy a car that isn't bad for American workers or works against the agenda of what we're doing here. I'm trying to do the right thing, but even if I got a Prius, that would be wrong here. It'd be wrong to them, but it would be right for environmental reasons. See, there's a weird line that you think.
Yeah, two words.
Yeah.
Road reliability.
Right. Well, there's the other problem is what American cars are really great cars and also fuel efficient. I've gotten some emails, but I still haven't. There's some I'm just not going to buy because I think I didn't like the way they looked.
Well, no. I'm going to tell you something. Now, American cars are getting better at fuel efficiency. They've, you know, Chevy and a couple of these other GM lines have introduced cars that get really good gas mileage. The issue, again, is road reliability, and that's where the American cars, unfortunately, if you believe the various consumer agencies that test these things, they fall short.
And, dude, I tell you, there's laws in L.A. where I'm going to be living that will give you compensation. They will. You get special privileges if you buy, like, a Prius.
Yeah.
You get to automatically go in the carpool lane for saving the money.
Yeah.
So this is still an open discussion. You know, I do not want to support something evil.
Oh, yeah, by the way, yeah. It is not the workers' fault that the chairman of GM decided to keep making SUVs when he could have been making hybrids, all right? That's not the workers' fault. That's the fault of management, but that's a decision they made.
Yeah, the weird thing is my family, my dad used to buy American cars when I was a kid all the time. Then
me
at
too.
Some point, we started getting Hondas.
Yep.
At some point, the Hondas came in. What are you going to do? So let's just do this real quick before we bring Jim on. What happened exactly today, Riley, in the Saddam trial? They went out, they came back in, and Ramsey Clark was not allowed to give an opening statement. Ramsey Clark, of course, a former Attorney General of the United States, now advising the Saddam defense, wanted to give an opening statement, you know, challenging the legitimacy of the court there in Iraq. He was not allowed to, and then they came back and they allowed him to. Is that what?
Yes, that's exactly what happened. They changed their minds. They decided to allow, because the prosecution said that no foreign reporters, foreign lawyers were supposed to address the court.
Right.
That it would have obviously include Ramsey Clark, and they all got up and walked out. They came back and the court reversed itself. They came back and remember, trying to recruit a replacement defense team might not be the easiest thing in the world to do, given what happened to at least two of Saddam's former defense lawyers.
And one of them bolted. Two of them were assassinated.
And one left the country.
Yeah, I got to get out of here. So let's get into this now, and we'll cover some more of this later. Unfortunately, it's that time of week again when we here at Morning Sedition take a moment at this time of sorrow to reflect in our morning remembrance.
As the people of a grieving nation come together to mourn, to remember, and finally to find hope, Morning Sedition joins with them to mourn, remember, and find hope as well. And so we bring you the stories of those who have lost their lives, those who inspire us to carry on. Here now is Morning Sedition grief correspondent, Mort Mortensen.
Ooh. Rough one, huh?
Oh, yeah. It's been a long weekend.
Yeah. You all right?
I'm all right. I've been partying.
What does that look like for you?
I can imagine.
Like this. Partying.
Compelling. Get on with it.
Michael Evans, Ronald Reagan's photographer.
Uh-huh.
Michael Evans, a photojournalist who took some of the best-known and most beloved photographs of Ronald Reagan, died at his home this week after his heart just said no to life. Evans was Reagan's personal photographer from 1975 to 1985, having taken over his duties from Reagan's previous photographers, starting with Thomas Edison. Old man Reagan was.
Very old.
Yeah.
Thomas Edison. Wow.
That goes back to the beginning.
Yeah, you have seven. You should blow your nose.
Well, thanks a lot. I'll use some of the new Air America tissue that they've distributed.
In the bathroom where you can only get one piece of toilet paper?
Sure.
Yeah.
Here goes.
Those sound soft.
Yeah, and absorbent. Sensitive, just like Brendan likes them. Evans' 1975 close-up photo of Reagan wearing a cowboy hat and smiling amiably became a symbol of the great communicator who once declared ketchup a vegetable, told all poor people he hoped they get botulism, and said trees cause more smog than cars. He said all those things. He's a great communicator.
I get it.
That's the premise.
How much laughter do you need to move on through this?
You don't need your cheap laughter. You can just sit there and shut up for all I care. I don't need your pity.
All right, let's try that.
Okay.
Why don't you go ahead?
Here we go.
Nobody laughs.
All right. By the way, thanks for dressing up this morning.
Oh, shut up. Get off.
Anyway, Evans once told NPR, quote, "What you saw with Ronald Reagan was what you got," adding, "which is why I knew he had to be stopped." That's pretty funny, eh, Riley?
Yeah, sure is. Hilarious. Yeah. A real knee slapper.
Well, you know, you'd laugh if you weren't staring at the web like you do most of the day.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Boy.
Yeah. That's because I'm trying to find news, something you're only casually acquainted with.
Excuse me, this isn't Morning Riley.
No.
Right, it's Morning Remembrance.
Okay. Do you remember what you're supposed to say?
Yeah.
Here we go.
Okay. Mr. Evans is survived by two daughters, a son, and countless negatives of Reagan forgetting how to put on his trousers.
Nice.
Herbert L. Strock, uh-huh. B-movie director. Herbert Strock, a pioneer television producer and director who directed the B-movie creature features I Was a Teenage Frankenstein, How to Make a Monster, and The Crawling Hand, has died after years of not being able to live up to the genius of his early work.
Oh, man.
Strock's 1979 masterpiece, The Monster, was also titled Monstroid.
and The Toxic Monster and Monster, the Legend That Became a Terror. And when those failed, Deep Throat.
Yeah.
But he's perhaps best remembered for his 1954 film GOG, in which two robots in charge of a secret underground space lab go mad in an attempt to stand up to the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Wow.
You go mad.
I gotta watch that. Sounds political.
It is. Oh. Strock's finely crafted films helped launch the acting careers of such greats as Gail Gainley, Greg Duncan, Ken Taylor, and of course, Whit Bissell.
Whit Bissell! Sure!
Remember him?
Yeah, of course I do.
Yeah, what do you remember him in?
That's a funny name that Whit Bissell has.
Yeah.
I don't remember him from anything, Jim.
Oh, God.
I mean, Morris?
This is so sad.
Jeez.
Strock requested his remains be distributed countrywide for less than a week at failing drive-ins, and then mocked for 45 years on late-night TV. And something funnier.
Whit Bissell.
Kalo, how you doing?
His name's Whit Bissell now.
Whit Bissell.
Yeah, Whit Bissell.
Who knows what he's doing now? He could be your accountant.
Yeah, Whit Bissell.
All righty.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
So,
you done?
Yeah.
Sure.
Do the sign-off.
This has been this week's Morton Remembrance with Mort Mortensen. Till next week, this is Mort Mortensen saying, who's chopping onions?
Wow, the shift. I got to get some out of my system. Hold on, I got to get another one out. One more.
There you go.
I've been fighting saying the SH word
all morning. Why is that?
It's right at the tip of my tongue. I feel like it's going to come out, and I want to freak Kayla out, but I've went twice and almost said it. And I don't know what's wrong with me. It's just at the tip of my tongue.
You in a mood or something? Some bad news?
Yeah.
Well, you shouldn't say it, man. You could get fired.
Oh, man. Wouldn't that be bad? Then Riley would have to host the show by himself for the next few years.
A few years?
That's going to happen. Yeah. 16 past the hour. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program continues with John Nichols. Hang on to your seats because brother's coming in.
Uh-oh.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yo.
Good morning. It's Monday. Hope you're holding up. This is our 10th of our last 10 shows. 9 will be tomorrow as we count down next week and do a lot of reflecting. Why not? It's the longest goodbye in radio history. Our next guest is the co-author, along with Robert McChesney. That guy writes millions of books, John.
Pumps him out, man.
McChesney's got a book out every couple weeks with Robert McChesney. The book is Tragedy and Farce, How the American Media Sells Wars, Spins Elections, and Destroys Democracy. He's the Nation Magazine's Washington correspondent. He's also the author of Dick, the Man Who Was President. John Nichols is someone we've always enjoyed here on Morning Sedition, so it's great to have him back in the studio. Haven't seen you live since the Republican National Convention.
That's
How
right.
How are you, John? Nice to see you, man.
Well, I'm just recovered from the convention.
Just there now? You just go. Got
yeah,
just,
I, took this a morning I woke up. And
just pulled it together?
Yeah, exactly. So, I went on a bit of a bender, me and the president.
So look, you know, before we get into the book proper, let's talk about a couple of things that are going down. First of all, what's going down is the GOP is going down. Am I right? The Republicans are going down. Just give us a little update. Tom DeLay, deep caca.
Yes? That man is never coming back. The beauty of Tom DeLay is, you know, it's like he created a den of thieves. Everybody around him is a crook and a cretin. I mean, really, the subhumans of the species. And then, you know, he like says, well, I'm only going to step down temporarily while I'm on trial. Like, this bunch of thugs is going to ever let him back. They've already taken his job. They took his furniture, everything. He's gone.
He's like the Frank Costello of the country.
Well, it is. The thing is, and they're like, well, of course we all still support him, but they're all, you know, like already maneuvering. There is no way Tom DeLay will ever be in Republican leadership again.
Wow, that's why they support him.
But it's not because of,
as long as he stands over there and doesn't get involved.
It's not because we sent him to jail or anything like that. It is simply because these guys are thugs. No, they're thugs. You move one of them out of the way, they're going to lop his head off.
So you're saying the whole idea of Republican loyalty is fraudulent.
That's not his boy, Roy Blunt.
Well, Roy Blunt was his boy, but that's why John Boehner from Ohio is running to take over. I mean, these guys are hustling like crazy. And remember, Blunt is as dirty as DeLay. I mean, they, you know, it's not like Blunt was DeLay's bagman. He actually held the money.
Right.
So, and so he's also the Abramoff.
Right. So, Michael Scanlon, who was DeLay's spokesman, was also is now Jack Abramoff's partner, Abramoff.
Well, not anymore.
Not anymore. But see, so he's talking. He's going to rat him out. Now, how many, tell me who they are, if you can, from your memory. Who's going down with Abramoff in this scandal, in this investigation of the Indian casino lobby?
Yeah. I mean, look, the fact is they were spreading money around like crazy. If you can imagine, Abramoff apparently made $80 million mm-hmm. off the Indian tribes. That's mm-hmm. you know, that's even in Washington, that's decent money.
Yeah.
And so he was moving that money around the way you get things done in Washington, bribe people. And what we know now is he gave major campaign contributions to better part of 24 Republican members, and then huge amounts of money to a certain group. Blunt was in the tens of thousands. Denny Hastert, over $100,000. Conrad Burns, the senator from Montana, $150,000. I mean, this is huge amounts of money.
For our listeners, John Nichols, co-author of Tragedy and Farce, How the American Media Sells War, Spin Elections, and Destroys Democracy. How'd you like that for a little reminder of who we're talking to?
I like that. It's very good.
John, refresh our listeners and me, if you could, if you can make it specific, exactly what Jack Abramoff did and why there's such a why the investigation is going on.
Well, you have to understand who Jack Abramoff is. Jack Abramoff is the son of some sort of Hollywood movie kind of guy who mm-hmm. decided to become a conservative, which is sort of sick and twisted in its first, you know, because in Hollywood you're not supposed to do that.
Yeah.
But he went conservative, and he went conservative very, very young. He was the president of the College Republicans nationally, mm-hmm. and his campaign manager for when he ran for president of College Republicans was Ralph Reed, his one buddy.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, you just look down the list. Everybody else who was associated with him back then is now basically in charge of the country.
Okay.
And so he thought, hey, here's an idea. I'll set up a lobbying shop and you know, influence all these people who came along. So then he goes out to Indian tribes, which are in a bad situation. They've suddenly got a lot of money mm-hmm. from casinos, and they want government action to let them open more casinos and do things. Nice little quid pro quo there.
Right.
Well, what he started doing was giving huge amounts of money to Republican politicians and their PACs, and a lot of favors. For instance, he flew Bob Ney, who's a congressman from Ohio, as well as several other congressmen, to Scotland to go golfing.
The big golf guy.
Yeah, it's not like going golfing in Alexandria
or
Virginia.
It's like going golfing in heaven.
Yeah, apparently. But you know what I mean? It's sort of like you go to Scotland.
Yeah. Yeah, at the home of golf.
Right? Yeah, you know, it's like, I'm not taking you out to Maryland. I'm taking you to Scotland. Yeah. And so he took a number of these guys there. And the bills from those trips are just unbelievable. They're in hundreds of thousands of dollars.
But the reason he did this was to get Congress people to get legislation to honor his Indian tribe.
Right, or to write letters. What we found is that Hastert, Blunt, all sorts of other
departments. Of the Interior.
Trent Lott, others. Yeah, they just send letters over to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which is basically scared anyway. If your job is to protect Indians in this administration, right, you know, mm-hmm. if these guys, Republicans, tell you to do something, you sort of say, oh, okay, I better do that. So they would send these letters over saying, boy, we'd really like, wink, wink, nod, nod, if you would take care of this tribe.
Mm-hmm.
Or screw this tribe, help this tribe.
Right.
And a lot of it happened, quite frankly.
Does John McCain have anything to do with the Department of Indian Affairs?
John McCain is actually a good guy in this one. John McCain has actually, because he comes from Arizona with a large Native American population, he's tried to make the Bureau of Indian Affairs independent and functional and not crooked, mm-hmm. for lack of a better term. And he's actually been at the forefront of investigating this. Again, and I hate to tell you this, this is going to shock you guys. It's not the Democrats that have been all over this thing. It's actually John McCain who's the one who sort of ripped this stuff open within the congressional level. But the fact is there are three criminal investigations going on regarding Abramoff and people associated with him.
John Nichols, I got to ask you, given Abramoff's relationship with the Department of the Interior, why has Gail Norton still got a gig?
Oh, my God. I mean, you know, look, but remember, you're right about that. You're right about that. Gail Norton, who was put in there solely to screw things up. But why does Denny Hastert still have a gig as Speaker of the House? The guy took over $100,000, wrote letters clearly tied to that. I mean, why? Forget about the Secretary of the Interior. Think about the Speaker of the House.
Well, let's think about it. Let's talk about it some more in just a couple of seconds. Our guest is John Nichols. Let's talk about the book, Tragedy and Farce, How the American Media Sells Wars, Spins Elections, and Destroys Democracy. It's Morning Sedition, 27 past the hour.
Listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
right now, Mark Lehner and Billy Goldberg, MD, the authors of Why Do Men Have Nipples? And you guys are the guys with answers. Let's take a call from John, calling from New Orleans. John, what's on your mind, buddy? What's your question?
Hey. What can you tell me about female ejaculation?
Okay, John, that's an important question, and it's a pressing question. It's an explosive question. Matt in Minnesota, what's going on?
What's up, Matt?
Let's say you make a political mistake and you order a big fat Domino's pizza and you got this big glob in your gut and you want to get rid of it.
Okay.
Well, here's what I do. I get a little bottle of that rubbing alcohol, isopropyl alcohol, and you rub it on your anus, and it's like a trigger, and your whole gut just empties right out into the toilet. Now, here's my question.
Yeah.
Is it bad if you rub it on your anus?
Well, these guys are getting the tough questions.
You got a lot of problems, Matt.
Yeah, really.
You've just eaten a wad of meat and cheese from a politically incorrect company, and you're actually wondering whether or not dipping your finger in alcohol and rubbing it on your butt.
Well, I don't know. Maybe that needs a psychologist. I don't know about that.
I'm just trying to help you. I've never done it before, but I can tell you one thing. I might have to try it. Okay, let's answer the cover question. Why do men have nipples?
We all start out from a female template, but we retain a vestige, a mammary memory of our original female.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. This explains my vagina.
Yeah.
It's just a vestigial vagina.
Oh, thank God, because I was worried. I haven't been using it. I just occasionally put rubbing alcohol on it when I wanted to ejaculate.
This has been another great moment in Morning Sedition history.
Remember the comedy. Remember the comedy. 35 past the hour. We're just talking to our buddy here, John Nichols, who's a co-author of Tragedy and Farce, How the American Media Sell Wars, Spin Elections, and Destroy Democracy. The power of comedy to get the word about politics out into the minds of the young people, John, is a very important thing that they're taking away from this network. But that's a whole other, that's an entire other conversation. But your book, this is a question. This is what we had. You're a lightning rod to talk to, man. You just go. And on the break, we were talking about, I was telling you, we're talking about Jack Abramoff and all the nuances of these investigations that Americans have no idea. They don't care. Most people, even if you look at the ratings of this network and progressive networks, it's not representing the bulk of people in this country. They don't know about politics. Why is that? Why don't people care?
Well, can I first say that following that last segment, I think we've perfectly set ourselves up for a discussion of contemporary American media.
That's the way this show works, man. Yeah, you go bang right from female ejaculation
rubbing alcohol on the anus is about what it's. And the fact of the matter is that American media right now, not you guys, but American media in general.
He's only saying that because we're here.
That's right. You always say that. It's a nice thing. It's a Washington thing. But it is so dumbed down coverage of politics that we've trained people not to pay attention to it. We actually, if you want to get the perfect sum up of how politics is covered in America, watch the Super Bowl and then watch election night coverage on any of the networks. They're identical. Both of them are spectator sports. They got commentators, they got maps, they made a play from the South. It looks like they're coming in from the West. And they have coaches, Karl Rove, Bob Schrum. Our coach isn't very good. And we hate our coach, the whole bit. But they've made politics a spectator sport, and that's not how you cover it. It doesn't work that way.
How do you do it then?
Well, the way you do it is, you don't do stenography to power. You don't go to the president and say, what'd you say, and then put it out. I'll give you a good example. Last week, the president gives a speech on Iraq. Speech on Iraq was everything he'd ever said before.
Yeah.
Now, I don't remember a lot from journalism school, but I do remember that if the big news event of the day falls through because nothing happens, which is what happened with the president, you push that aside and you look for something else. Like maybe that Nancy Pelosi, the leader of the congressional opposition, for the first time comes out for an end to the war.
Yep.
So instead, though, they're so on their tracks, they still put Bush up front. He's the lead story. He's the news. Pelosi is buried even in the New York Times inside the Bush story. You should reverse that. But the people who are doing media today are, by and large, so deferent to power, so on their track, that they just don't know how to do it. They actually aren't good at doing it anymore.
And
the American people suffer as a result, because you train the ability to kind of follow politics out of people. Now, if you think people are stupid, think of this. Everybody in America knows who Natalie Holloway is. That woman is missing down in Aruba. They know when she went missing. They know all these details.
It's funny. I didn't know who she was when he said it.
You're obviously not an American, or at least not a loyal American.
No, I'm certainly not.
But what I'm saying is, we take these scandals, O.J. Simpson. We can follow the intricacies and the details of that, right? Because media covers it intensely and with an idea to make it entertaining and gripping and engaging. We don't cover politics that way. And well, because of that, it gets lost.
Okay, but Natalie Holloway is not, as a topic, some sort of duplicitous, disingenuous jerk who's trying to mislead the American people. And so many of these TV outlets are actually corporate interests of certain people. It just seems impossible to me to make it as compelling as what you're saying.
Oh, come on. No. I mean, look, Jack Abramoff. Just use the scandal we were just talking about.
I think it's compelling.
It's more than compelling. There's a murder scandal associated with it. Some guy ended up dead down in Florida. I'm not saying Abramoff killed him. What I'm saying is
that's
a thing to investigate. Well, I'm telling you, you start to get into, you know, bribes, murder, tens of millions of dollars. I mean, people go to see The Godfather. I don't see why they wouldn't go to see this.
Well, maybe they should do it like those CSI shows where you have the compelling music and like Jack Abramoff.
Why not?
Yeah, no.
Why not? Because we do that with OJ. Look, they had a theme developed. You know, every time a poor little girl, and it's totally sympathetic, goes missing in Alabama or Florida or California, they got a theme developed for
it. Well, it's
got to
be a white
right?
girl, though.
Well, I realize that, you know, and blonde, preferably.
Yes.
But what I'm saying is they've got theme music, they've got images. You know, this Natalie Holloway has been missing since May. It's interesting that she went missing at the same time that the Downing Street memo came out, revealing that, you know, essentially we'd been lied into war.
So you're saying Tony Blair is responsible for Natalie Holloway?
Well, was he in Aruba that night?
I know.
I mean, let's just check. He was on vacation. Well, so all I'm saying is, though, if we had covered the Downing Street memo with half the intensity, you know, the theme music, the images, all that we covered Natalie Holloway, I think we'd be out of the war.
But now, answer me.
It's a choice.
It's that powerful, certainly. Yeah.
Answer me a question. Because the American media covered Chandra Levy's disappearance just as intensely as they did Natalie Holloway's. Mm-hmm. How many Americans do you think know how that was resolved?
Well, nobody does because September 11th interrupted. Honest to God, think about this.
Well, how was it resolved?
It wasn't
Gary Condon.
Yeah, Gary was innocent after he lost his seat.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, that's a very good example. Because this is why American media actually does tremendous damage. I mean, it's more than just being stupid. It's dangerous. In the summer of 2001, the two big stories, you look back, were Gary Condit and all that Chandra Levy stuff, and particularly the stewardess that was dating him, and the chains on the bed stuff. It's getting very good. Yeah. We knew more about Gary Condit's sex life than you know about your own. And so we're getting all this stuff. They love that. And then the other thing was shark attacks in Florida.
Yes.
So we spent a whole summer on Gary Condit's sex life, shark attacks in Florida. Now, the interesting thing was that it was during that summer that they said, oh, yeah, but Osama bin Laden wants to attack America. Well, Bush didn't pay attention, but neither did the media, because there was all, you know, people, if you were seriously covering terrorism, threats to America, if you actually had people covering
it. People were getting attacked by sharks, John.
Well, there you go. But you know what they found out?
What?
At the end of the season, there were no more shark attacks in 2001 than there had been the previous year. It was just a good story.
Am I right in saying that, and I've said this for a while, that there's no left-wing media, there is irresponsible media, and there's right-wing media?
Essentially, you're right. I mean, and one of the things I remind people of is if you took Fox and Limbaugh, if you just got rid of Fox and Limbaugh, which, you know, not a bad idea, but if you got rid of them, we would still be at war in Iraq. Because if you looked at CNN, ABC, NBC, CBS's coverage, and Judith Miller in the New York Times, you would see a cheerleading squad for the executive branch. That's just the bottom line. And so what we really need to do is break our media up. I mean, really break it down into much smaller parts and have it be, you know, I'm actually for a weird thing that's kind of forgotten in America. It's called the free market, i.e. have competing voices out there that are trying to break the news and get to good stories and do stories better, which gets to your point of maybe somebody would figure out how to do it in an entertaining way.
Well, I'm going to do a very niche-oriented media outlet. I'm going to be working out of my garage in Los Angeles in a couple of weeks. I'm going to be on an invitation-only basis.
Yeah, that's, well, you know, it's like
you can get me on your cell phone.
Have you seen these new ads now for PBS and for CNN where they have somebody like in their office eating a sandwich and then all the correspondents come in and talk to them? I mean, they're trying to, quote-unquote, form relationships with people. So you may have a, you know, there may be a future in that.
I guess my big concern and my big question is that how do you get young people to engage with the real issues in terms of how much this administration has bankrupt this country, what it's going to be like to recover from this administration, the legislation that's going to have to be turned around by responsible Democrats or independents that we hopefully get into Congress. I mean, to me, that is the future, is that so much has to be turned back now because of the damage this administration does, is how do we engage in that?
This is not merely a media story. This is also a political story. The Democratic Party has to stop being a managerial party.
Uh-huh.
What the Democratic Party offers you now is if you put us in power, we will run the mess that the Republicans made better. Right? Yeah, we'll be good managers.
Okay. Absolutely.
Now, I'm not going to vote for a good manager. Because right now the Republicans let me run my debt up. I don't have to pay taxes. And yeah, half the country's falling apart, but if I'm okay, no problem. But Democrats have to offer something different. They have to say, you give us power, and we're going to create something fundamentally different. We're going to make the rich pay their taxes. And you know, let's be honest, it's a very simple method. You say, we're going to shake the rich down, use that money to give you some health care, some education, some daycare. We're going to get ourselves out of these stupid wars overseas, come home. We're going to use a lot of that money to do a lot more stuff. And in the end, at the end of a Democratic administration, things are going to be better. Things are going to be different. If you can't promise that, if all you say is, we're going to go in there, we're going to manage the deficit, we're going to do that better than Republicans, then they're never going to get the majorities they need, the power they need to really rule. That's now, the bottom line.
And the bottom line, oh, go ahead, Mark.
No, there was something I wanted to ask you because it ties into what you just said. You know, you mentioned Bush's speech last week. Right. And apparently the Times ran a big piece about this guy from Duke University who was the crafter of the speech for him. And he said that if the American people believe that the war in Iraq can be won, then eventually Bush's numbers will change. Do you believe that?
I think you're probably right. Yeah. I mean, look, the American people, our media, as we talk about in the book, our media has not covered the war on terrorism. At all. Mm-hmm. Every time they find some new guy in Pakistan, they kill some guy in Pakistan, we're always told, well, he was the number five guy in Al-Qaeda.
Number three today.
We've had like the number, we've had all 20 of the top guys.
Number twos.
This is the fourth number three.
They keep getting killed.
Sure.
Right? But the fact is, it's because nobody knows what the war on terror is about. So because it hasn't been covered, yes, it can easily be manipulated. That's the bottom line. The Bush administration, Karl Rove in particular, figured out very early on that you can take this whole war on terror and use it not as an actual war on terror, but as sort of a template that you move around and put on whatever issues are in play. And the fact of the matter is, yes, Bush could theoretically turn this thing around, but it will be pure spin. Nothing will get better. And the fact is, you know, the New York Times yesterday had a front page story about the five Al-Qaeda guys, Taliban guys in Afghanistan who walked out of prison. Now, why weren't they the top five in Al-Qaeda? We don't know that they weren't.
Who knows? Now, do you talk about that template in the book, the Rove template?
We do. And we talk a lot about one of the things that our favorite fact in the book is that Karl Rove revealed in February of 2004, after Kerry had been surely locked in as the Democratic nominee, that the guy he really feared, even after the scream, Howard Dean, because Rove said Dean would bring the war up. And no matter what you throw at people, if you've got an anti-war candidate in those debates, we're in trouble.
Wow. So the book is A Tragedy, How the American Media Sell Wars, Spin Elections, and Destroy Democracy. Tragedy and Farce is the full name. I was reading off the cover and see, and Farce is down there.
Well, Farce is above Cheney's picture.
Our guest has been John Nichols, a very exciting, smart guy. Thanks for being with us.
My brothers, sorry you're going off the air. I have loved being on with you over the years.
I appreciate it, man. I appreciate it. Riley will be here.
It won't be the same. The magic.
I know. Well, we're going to come back with some real political activism. Brendan McDonald. Donald is going to take action against a single sheet dispensing toilet paper thing. 47 past Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on the air and online. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
About what John Kerry's made up, just spend 3 minutes with the men who served with him.
John Kerry? He bad.
John Kerry bad.
I don't like him.
John Kerry bad.
John Kerry loses.
Me no like John Kerry.
He not good.
John Kerry's my poop.
Fire truck.
John Kerry not good.
Kerry no good.
Bad.
I don't like John Kerry.
John Kerry took my shoe.
Swift Book Veterans for Truth is responsible for the content of this advertisement.
This has been another great moment in Morning Sedition history.
Hey, it's 52 past the hour. We're going to land this thing. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
The show is Morning's Edition. A lot of political action going on around the toilet paper dispensers here at Air America Radio. Single sheet dispensers, which completely... Brendan,
how do they do that?
Ruined Brendan McDonald's day to the point where it ruined his week last week, Riley. You missed it because it's sacred time to Brendan. He's a guy that likes to have that sacred time in the bathroom uninterrupted by the frustration that comes with a single wipe toilet paper, a single sheet toilet paper thing. And then we found out that the women here are very upset as well, and it really thinks we think it debilitates some workers. We think it takes too much time. Here's a letter from a guy that says that an employee making $40,000 a year is earning about 32 cents per minute. If his time in the stall is increased by just 1 minute due to the inconvenience of one sheet dispensing, an entire roll of paper could be bought every two visits. You know, and we've had enough. And a female employee who's going to be remain unidentified here at Air America has provided Brendan McDonald with the tool necessary to take action. We go to Brendan McDonald in the bathroom here at Air America Radio. Brendan, what's going on in there? What are you doing?
What's up, man?
That's right, Mark and Mark. I was given a hacksaw by a very generous member of the Air America staff. We have enacted a political momentum here, guys.
Yeah.
And it's going to play itself out. Right now, I am going to saw off the protective device that is preventing us from pulling more than two sheets at a time.
Good for you.
Toilet paper roll.
Good for you.
I'm going to do it right now on the air, okay? You guys, I'm going to put you on the speakerphone, and we are going to saw this puppy off.
Okay.
Let's take back the streets, man.
All right, here it goes.
All right.
Can you hear that?
Yeah, we hear it. That's great. That's a...
We made one cut. All right, we're already... I'm halfway through. I have to make one more incision. Oh, my God, we're going. And victory.
Victory.
Free at last! I can wipe my ass!
Free at last! He's free at last.
And we have David, our intern Goliath in here, is taking a victory photograph right now.
Yeah.
And we are going to post that at morningsedition.com. We have enacted a great momentum here, a political momentum, and don't let anybody ever tell you that you can't. One man can't make a difference. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Brendan McDonald. He has freed the toilet paper for the people. I hope he goes into the women's room because they apparently have a big problem as well. He's probably got his morning cut out for him with that hacksaw. I don't know what kind of I don't know what kind of trouble that's going to cause here. Who's responsible for those damn things? But who says you can't facilitate political and social change? In your own life. Brendan McDonald taking the steps this morning. I'm proud of him, man. I'm proud of him. And I hope he finds a better job. Now it's... he's got the hacksaw in the booth. Thank you, man. There's a liberal agenda. Praise, first, liberal agenda, marching orders. One, praise the thousands of activists who flooded the streets of Hong Kong to demand democracy. Try to plan something similar here, provided your schedule doesn't get too crazy around the holidays. Two, use New York world premiere of King Kong to stage a PETA anti-fur protest. Three, this holiday season, remember 'twas the night before the non-denominational holiday. Four, pay Iraqi journalists to plant pro-abortion, pro-gay marriage, and anti-Bush articles in Iraqi papers. And five, send the White House your own addendum to their plan for victory entitled Backup Plan for Humiliation. Phrase of the day, just dropped this in the conversation. It turns out the Justice Department lawyers always thought the Texas redistricting plan pushed by Tom DeLay was illegal. The biggest clue, it was being pushed by Tom DeLay.
Great.
Wake up, sheeple. You don't need a weatherman to know that this blows. So now, before we go into what we're going to have tomorrow, looks like we got about another minute. Brendan, you feel strong? You feel empowered?
Oh, it was great, man.
You know what? I'm getting a lot of emails, Riley, about our conversation about American-made and Japanese-made cars. You know, I took some flack from some United Auto Workers Union members, and some other people are writing in about American cars being stinky. And maybe we should have that conversation tomorrow morning. I don't want to get her on the phone, but I want to say hi to Jenna, who has been listening to all last week. She's been in the hospital up there in Minneapolis. She had surgery on her knees, and we didn't have time to talk to her today. And she's probably pretty loopy on the OxyContin, and we only got about a half hour. But I hope you're doing well. What do we got going on tomorrow, Riley?
That's a good question, because I don't think I got a cheat sheet.
I got it. Comedian Jim David, who is very funny, always funny on this show, very excited Jim David. And director Stephen Kagan, the guy who directed Syriana. We had Bob Baer in a week or so ago. Let's get the filmmaker's angle on that. And, of course, Chris Hedges, one of our favorite guests.
Oh, yeah.
Who is currently working on a book about the Christian right called American Fascism, tentatively. We'll see how that's going. So
we're
going
to do all of that and a whole lot more. Air America Radio. We'll be right back.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.